Most of the ships closer to shore still flew the Imperial Carisian flag above the green, scepter-badged banner of the Church of God awaiting. A handful still showed red and green banners with the crossed scepter and sabre of the Harchong Empire instead, but most of those were moored farther out, or in one of the other anchorages. King's Harbour was more concerned with the ships which had been fully armed, and surveyors and petty officers swarmed over those vessels like locusts. Their reports would tell Rockpoint how quickly the prize vessels could be put into Carisian service, assuming he could find crews for them, of course. And with Brian Lock Island's death, that decision would be his, at least until Caleb could get home. "An embarrassment of riches, that's what it is," he thought. "Thank God the church doesn't have them any more. But what the hell am I going to do with all of them?" He shook his head and turned back from the window to the two officers he'd actually come here to see. Commodore Sir Alfred Heinrich, Baron Seamount, stood before one of the slate sheets which covered his office's walls. As always, the cuffs of his sky-blue uniform tunic were dusted with chalk, and the fingers of his good hand were stained with ink. The short, plump Seamount was about as far removed from the popular imagination's image of a sea officer as it would be possible to get. Yet his fertile brain and driving energy were one of the primary reasons all those prize ships were anchored in King's Harbour this sunny summer afternoon. The rail-thin, black-haired commander, standing respectfully to one side, was at least 10 or 12 years younger than Seamount. He radiated all the intensity and energy people tended not to notice just at first in his superior officer, and his left hand was heavily bandaged. "It's good to see you, Alfred," Rockpoint said. "I apologize for not getting out here sooner, but—" He shrugged, and Seamount nodded. "I understand, sir. You've had a lot to do." The Commodore's eyes dropped to the enormous Rottweiler lying quietly beside his desk. Rockpoint had inherited the acting rank of High Admiral from Brian Lock Island, but Seamount had inherited Keel Hall. Frankly, the Commodore was more than a little surprised the big, boisterous dog had survived his master's death. For the first couple of 5 days, he'd been afraid Keel Hall was going to grieve himself to death, and he still hadn't fully regained the exuberance which had always been so much a part of him. "Yes, I have," Rockpoint inhaled deeply, then crossed to one of the officers' armchairs. His peg leg thumped on the stone floor, the sound quite different from the sound his remaining shoe made, and he seated himself with a sigh of relief. "Yes, I have," he repeated. "But I finally managed to steal a couple of days away from all the reams of paperwork, so why don't the two of you dazzle me with what you've been up to while I've been away?" "I don't know if dazzle is exactly the right word, sir," Seamount replied with a smile. "I do think you're going to be impressed, though. Pleased, too, I hope." "I'm always impressed by your little surprises, Alfred," Rockpoint said dryly. "Of course, sometimes I'm not so sure I'm going to survive them. We'll try to get you back to Destroyer undamaged, sir." "I'm vastly reassured. Now, about those surprises." "Well, there are several of them, actually, sir." Seamount crossed to the slate wall and reached for a piece of chalk. Rockpoint watched him a bit warily. The Commodore was a compulsive sketcher who had a tendency to illustrate his points enthusiastically. "First, sir, as you suggested last time you were both here," Seamount continued, "I've had Commander Mandrain and the experimental board finishing up the work on the rifled artillery pieces. Master Hausmann's provided us with the first 3 wire-wound pieces, and they've performed admirably. They're only 12-pounders, although the shot weight's actually closer to 24 pounds, given how much longer it is in proportion to its diameter. But as proof of the concept, they've been completely satisfactory. Master Hausmann is confident he could go to production on much heavier weapons if and when you and their Majesties should determine the time is right." "That's excellent news, Alfred. Rockpoint's smile of pleasure was completely genuine, even though he'd already known what Seamount was going to report. Edward Huisman had kept him fully informed. Unfortunately, Seamount wasn't part of the inner circle, which meant explaining how Rockpoint could have come by his knowledge would have been a trifle difficult. "I'm not sure how our sudden acquisition of so many galleons is going to affect that decision," he continued. "On the one hand, we've already revealed the existence of the shell-firing smoothbores, and I'm sure that bastard Clintan is going to provide dispensations right and left while the Church works on duplicating them. I still don't see the additional theoretical range being all that valuable in a sea fight, what with the ship's relative motion, but I'm beginning to think that if Edward has the capacity available, it might not be a bad idea to begin manufacturing and stockpiling the rifled pieces. That way they'd be available quickly if and when, as you say, we decide to shift over to them." "I'll look into that, sir," Seamount said, chalk clacking as he turned to make a note to himself on the waiting slate. "It'll probably mean he needs to further increase his wire-drawing capacity as well, so the additional lead time would almost certainly be a good thing." Rockpoint nodded, and Seamount nodded back. "Second," he continued, "at that same meeting you suggested Commander Mandrain give some thought to the best way to protect a ship from shellfire. He's done that, and discussed it with Sir Dustin Oliver as well. We don't have anything like a finished plan yet, but a few things have become evident to us." "Such as?" Rockpoint prompted, and Seamount gestured for Mandrain to take over. "Well," the commander said, in the soft, surprisingly melodious tenor which always sounded just a bit odd to Rockpoint, coming out of someone who seemed so intense, "the first thing we realized was that wooden armor simply won't work, sir. We can make the ship's scantlings thicker, but even if they're too thick for a shell to actually smash through them, we can't make them thick enough to guarantee it won't penetrate into them before it detonates. If that happens, it would be almost as bad as no armor at all. It could even be worse, given the fire hazard of how much worse the splinters would be. Another objection to wood is its weight. It's a lot more massive for the same strength than iron, and the more we looked at it, the more obvious it became that iron armor that prevented shells from penetrating at all, or actually broke them up on impact, was the only practical answer." "Practical?" Rockpoint asked with a faint smile, and Mandrain chuckled sourly. "Within limits, sir, within limits," the commander shrugged. "Actually, Master Huisman seems to feel that with his new smelting processes and the heavier hammer and rolling mills those accumulators of his make possible, he probably can provide iron plate to us in useful thicknesses and dimensions within the next 6 months to a year. He's not sure about quantities yet, but my observation's been that every one of his estimates for increased productivity has erred on the side of conservatism. And one thing's certain, we haven't seen any evidence that anyone on the other side would be in a position to match his production for years to come."
"That's true enough," Rockpoint conceded.
In fact, it was even truer than Mandrain realized, although that didn't mean enough small foundries couldn't produce at least some useful quantities of armor, even using old-fashioned muscle power to hammer out the plates. "Assuming Master Huisman can manufacture the plate, and that we can come up with a satisfactory way of securing it to the hull, there are still going to be weight considerations," Mandrain continued. "Iron gives better protection than wood, but building in enough protection out of anything to stop shellfire is going to drive up displacements. That's one of the problems I've been discussing with Sir Dustin. I understand Dr. Macklin at the college is also working with Sir Dustin on mathematical ways to predict displacements and sail power and stability. I'm afraid I'm not too well informed on that, and neither is Sir Dustin for that matter. He's a practical designer of the old school, but he's at least willing to give Dr. Macklin's formulas a try once they're finished. In the meantime, though, it's obvious hull strength is already becoming an issue in our current designs. There's simply an upper limit on the practical dimensions and weights which can be constructed out of a material like wood, and we're approaching them rapidly. Sir Dustin's been working on several ways to reinforce the hull's longitudinal strength, including diagonal planking and angled trusses between frames, but the most effective one he's come up with uses iron. Basically, he's boring holes in the ship's frames, then using long iron bolts between adjacent frames to stiffen the hull. Obviously, he hasn't had very long to observe the approach's success at sea, but so far, he says it looks very promising. When I approached him about the notion of hanging iron armour on the outside of the ship, however, he told me immediately that he didn't think a wooden hull was going to be very practical. I'd already expected that response, so I asked him what he thought about going to a ship that was wooden planked, but iron framed. Frankly, I expected him to think the notion was preposterous, but it turns out he'd already been thinking in that direction himself. In fact, his suggestion was that we should think about building the entire ship out of iron. Rockpoint's eyes widened, and this time his surprise was genuine. Not at the notion of iron or steel-hulled vessels, but at the discovery that Sir Dustin Oliver was already thinking in that direction. "I can see where that would offer some advantages," he said after a moment. "But I can see a few drawbacks, too. For example, you can repair a wooden hull almost anywhere. A shattered iron frame member would be just a bit more difficult for the carpenters to fix. And then there's the question of whether or not even Master Houseman could produce iron in quantities like that." "Oh, I agree entirely, sir. I was impressed by the audacity of the suggestion, though, and the more I've thought about it, the more I have to say I believe the advantages would vastly outweigh the drawbacks, assuming, as you say, Master Houseman could produce the iron we needed. That's for the future, however. For the immediate future, the best we're going to be able to do is to go to composite building techniques, with iron frames and wooden planking. And the truth is that that'll give us significant advantages over all wooden construction." "I can see that. At the same time, I'd be very reluctant to simply scrap all the ships we've already built, not to mention the ones we've just captured, and start over with an entirely new construction technique." "Yes, sir. As an intermediate step, we've been looking at the possibility of cutting an existing galleon down by a full deck. We'd sacrifice the spar deck armament and completely remove the forecastle and quarter deck. That should save us enough weight to allow the construction of an iron casement to protect the broadside guns. We'd only have a single armed deck, but the guns would be much better protected. And we've also been considering that with shell-firing weapons, we could reduce the number of broadside guns and actually increase the destructiveness of the armament. Our present thinking is that we might completely remove the current Krakens and all the carronades from a ship like Destroyer, say, and replace them with half as many weapons with an 8 or 9-inch bore. A smaller gun would fire a solid, rifled shot, somewhere around 180 to 200 pounds. The shell would probably be about half that, allowing for the bursting charge. In an emergency, it could fire a 68-pound round shot, which would still be more destructive than just about anything else currently at sea. Rate of fire would drop significantly with that many fewer guns, Rockpoint pointed out, and Mandrain nodded. "Absolutely, sir. On the other hand, each hit would be enormously more destructive. It takes dozens of hits, sometimes hundreds, to drive a galleon out of action with solid shot. A handful of 100-pound exploding shells would be more than enough to do the job. And just to indicate how the weapons would scale, a rifled 30-pounder shot would weigh about 90 pounds, which would give you a shell weight of only 45 or so, so you can see the advance the larger gun has. Of course, a smoothbore 30-pounder shell is only around 25 pounds, and its bursting charge is proportionately lighter as well. And if both sides start armouring their vessels with iron, anything much lighter than 8 inches
probably won't penetrate anyway.
That sounds logical enough, Rockpoint acknowledged. We'll have to think about it, of course. Fortunately, it's not a decision we're going to have to make any time soon.
I'm afraid we might have to make it sooner than you may be thinking, sir, Seamount put in.
Rockpoint looked at him, and the Commodore shrugged. You're talking about the possibility of beginning production and stockpiling weapons, sir, he reminded his superior. If we're going to do that, we're going to have to decide which weapons to build first.
Now that, Alfred, is a very good point, Rockpoint agreed. Very well, I'll be thinking about it, and I'll discuss it with the Emperor as soon as possible.
Thank you, sir, Seamount smiled. In the meantime, we have a few other thoughts that should be more immediately applicable to our needs.
You do?
Yes. You may have noticed Commander Mandrain's hand, sir.
You mean that fathom of gauze wrapped around it? Rockpoint asked dryly.
Exactly, sir. Seamount held up his own left hand, which had been mangled by an explosion many years before. I think Irvin was trying to do me one better. Unfortunately, he failed. All of his fingers are still intact, more or less.
I'm relieved to hear it. Exactly what bearing does that have on our present discussion, however?
Well, what actually happened, sir, Seamount said more seriously, is that we've been experimenting with better ways to fire our artillery. The flintlocks we've gone to are far, far better than the old slow match and linstock or heated irons we used to use, that most of our new prizes guns are still using, for that matter. But they still aren't as efficient as we could wish. I'm sure you're even better aware than we are here at the experimental board of how many misfires we still experience, especially when there's a lot of spray around or it's raining. So we've been looking for a more reliable method, and we've found one.
You have?
Rockpoint's eyes narrowed.
Actually, we've come up with two of them, sir, Seamount shrugged.
Both work, but I have to admit to a strong preference for one of them over the other.
Go on.
Dr. Lywis at the college gave us a whole list of ingredients to experiment with. One of them was something called fulminated quicksilver, which is very attractive on the face of it. You can detonate it with a single sharp blow, and the explosion is very hot. It would reduce lock time significantly as well, which would undoubtedly improve accuracy. The problem is that it's very corrosive, and another difficulty is that it's too sensitive. We've experimented with ways of moderating its sensitivity by mixing in other ingredients, like powdered glass, and we've had some success, but any fuses using fulminated quicksilver are going to tend to corrode over time, and according to Dr. Lywis, they'll lose much of their power as they do. For that matter, she says at least some of them would probably detonate spontaneously if they were left in storage long enough. They do have the advantage that they're effectively impervious to damp, however, which would be a major plus for sea service.
I can see where that would be true, Rockpoint agreed.
We've pushed ahead with developing those fuses. For the moment, we're calling them fulminating fuses after the quicksilver, although Irvin is pushing for calling them percussion fuses, since they're detonated by a blow. But I decided we should explore some other possibilities as well, which brought me to Shunwei's candles. Rockpoint nodded. Shunwei's candles was the name which had been assigned to what had once been called strike-anywhere matches back on old Terra. Well, basically, what we've come up with, sir, is a tube. We're using the same sort of quills we've been using with the artillery flintlocks at the moment, although I think it's going to be better to come up with a metallic tube in the long run. Probably made out of copper or tin, filled with the same compound we use in one of Shanwei's candles. It's sealed with wax at both ends, and we insert a serrated wire into it lengthwise. When the wire is snatched out, friction ignites the compound in the tube, and that ignites the main charge in the gun. As far as we can tell,
It's as reliable as the fulminating fuses, even in heavy weather, as long as the wax seals are intact before the wire's pulled. It's less corrosive as well, and it lets us dispense with hammerlock mechanisms completely. For that matter, we could easily go directly to it on existing guns which are already designed to take the quills we're using with the flintlocks.
I like it, Rockpoint said with unfeigned enthusiasm. In fact, I like it a lot, especially the easily part.
He grinned, but then he raised one eyebrow.
Exactly how do the commander's damaged fingers figure into all of this, though? Did he burn them on one of the candles?
Not precisely, sir. Seamount shook his head. I said I prefer the friction-ignited fuses for artillery, and I do, but Irwin's been exploring other possible uses for the fulminating fuses, and he's come up with a fascinating one.
Oh? Rockpoint looked at the commander, who actually seemed a little flustered under the weight of his suddenly intense gaze.
"Why don't you go get your toy, Irwin?" Seamount suggested.
"Of course, sir. With your permission, High Admiral?"
Rockpoint nodded, and Mondrain disappeared. A few minutes later, the office door opened once more, and he walked back in carrying what looked like a standard rifled musket. "It occurred to us, sir," he said, holding the rifle in a rough port-arms position as he faced Rockpoint, "that the Marines and the Army were going to need reliable primers for their artillery as well, and that if we were going to provide them for the guns, we might as well see about providing them for small arms as well, which is what this is." He grounded the rifle butt on the floor and reached into the right side pocket of his tunic for a small disc of copper, which he extended to Rockpoint. The High Admiral took it a bit gingerly and stood, moving closer to the window to get better light as he examined it. It wasn't the flat disc he'd thought it was at first. Instead, it was hollowed on one side. A cup, not a disc, and there was something inside the hollow. He looked at it for a moment longer, then turned back to Mondrain.
"Should I assume the stuff inside this?"
He held up the disc, indicating the hollow side with the index finger of his other hand.
"Is some of that fulminating quicksilver of yours?"
"It is, sir. Sealed with a drop of varnish. And this," Mondrain held up his bandaged hand, "is a reminder to me of just how sensitive it is. But what you have in your hand is what we're calling a primer cap, at least for now. We call it that because it fits down over this." He raised the rifle and cocked the hammer, indicating a raised nipple which had replaced the priming pan of a regular flintlock.
"Like a cap or a hat."
He turned the weapon, and Rockpoint realized the striking face of the hammer wasn't flat. Instead, it had been hollowed out into something a fraction larger than the cap in his hand.
"We discovered early on that when one of the caps detonates, it tends to spit bits and pieces in all directions," Mondrain said wryly, touching a scar on his cheek, which Rockpoint hadn't noticed. "The flash from a regular flintlock can be bad enough. This is worse, almost as bad as the flash from one of the old matchlocks. So we ground out the face of the hammer. This way, it comes down over the top of the nipple, which confines the detonation. It's actually a lot more pleasant to fire than a flintlock.
And it does the same thing for reducing misfires and being immune to rain you were talking about where artillery is concerned, Alfred?" Rockpoint asked intently.
"Exactly, sir."
Seamount beamed proudly at Mondrain. "Irwin here and his team have just found a way to increase the reliability of our rifles materially. And the conversion's fairly simple, too."
"Very good, Commander," Rockpoint said sincerely.
But Seamount raised one hand. "He's not quite finished yet, sir."
"He's not?"
Rockpoint looked speculatively at the Commander, who looked more flustered than ever.
"No, he's not, sir. And this next bit was entirely his own idea."
"Indeed.
And what else do you have to show me, Commander?"
"Well, this, sir." Mondrain raised the rifle again, and Rockpoint suddenly noticed a lever on its side. He had overlooked it when he examined the modified lock mechanism, but now the commander turned it. There was a clicking sound, and the acting High Admiral's eyebrows rose as the breech of the rifle seemed to break apart. A solid chunk of steel, perhaps an inch and a half long, moved smoothly back and down, and he could suddenly see into the rifle's bore. The rifling grooves were clearly visible against the brightly polished interior, and Mondrain looked up at him. "One of the things we've been thinking about in terms of the new artillery is ways to speed rate of fire, sir," he said. "Obviously, if we could think of some way to load them from the breech end, instead of having to shove the ammunition down the barrel, it would help a lot. The problem is coming up with a breech mechanism strong enough to stand the shock, quick enough to operate in some practical time frame, and one that seals tightly enough to prevent flash from leaking out disastrously every time you fire the piece. We haven't managed to solve those problems for artillery, but thinking about the difficulties involved suggested this to me." "Exactly what is this, Commander?" Rockpoint asked warily, not quite able to believe what he was seeing. The possibility of breech-loading artillery, far less a breech-loading rifle, was one after which he had hungered ever since gaining access to Owl's records, but he had never imagined he might be seeing one this quickly, especially without having pushed its development himself. "Well," Mondrain said again, "the way it works is like this, sir." He reached back into his pocket and extracted a peculiar-looking rifle cartridge. It was a bit larger than the ones riflemen carried in their cartridge boxes, and there were two oddities about its appearance. For one thing, the paper was a peculiar greyish colour, not the tan or cream of a standard cartridge, and for another, it ended in a thick, circular base of some kind of fabric that was actually broader than the cartridge itself. "The cartridge paper's been treated with the same compound we use in Shanwei's candle, sir," Mondrain said. "It's not exactly the same mix, but it's close. That means the entire cartridge is combustible, and it's sealed with paraffin to damp-proof it. The paraffin also helps to protect against accidental explosions, but with the new caps, the flash from the lock is more than enough to detonate the charge through the coating. And because the pan doesn't have to be separately primed, the rifleman doesn't have to bite off the bullet and charge the weapon with loose powder. Instead, he just slides it into the breech, like this." He inserted the cartridge into the open breech, pushing it as far forward as it would go with his thumb, and Rockpoint realized a slight lip had been machined into the rear of the opened barrel. The disc of fabric at the cartridge's base fitted into the lip, although it was thicker than the recess was deep. "Once he's inserted the round," Mondrain went on, "he pulls the lever back up like this." He demonstrated, and the movable breech block rose back into place, driving firmly home against the fabric base, which seals the breech again. "There's a heavy mechanical advantage built into the lever, sir, so that it actually crushes the felt on the end of the cartridge into the recess. That provides a flash-tight seal that's worked perfectly in every test firing. And after a round's been fired, the rifleman simply lowers the breech block again and pushes the next round straight in. The cartridges have stiffened walls to keep them from bending under the pressure, and what's left of the base from the previous round is shoved into the barrel, where it actually forms a wad for the next round." Rockpoint stared at the young naval officer for several seconds, then shook his head slowly. "That's brilliant," he said, with the utmost sincerity. "Yes, it is, sir," Seamount said proudly. "And while it isn't quite as simple as changing a flintlock out for one of the new percussion locks, fitting existing rifles with the new breech mechanism will be a lot faster than building new weapons from scratch. You've just doubled or tripled our Marines' rate of fire, Commander," Rockpoint said. "And I'm no Marine, far less a soldier, but it would seem to me that being able to load your weapon as quickly lying down as standing up would have to be a huge advantage in combat as well." "I'd like to think so, sir," Mondrain said. His usually intense eyes lowered themselves to the floor for a moment, then looked back up at Rockpoint, dark and serious. "There are times I feel pretty useless, sir," he admitted. "I know what Commodore Seamount and I do is important, but when I think about what other officers face at sea, in combat, I feel, well, like a slacker. It doesn't happen very often, but it does happen. So if this is really going to help, I'm glad." "Commander," Rockpoint rested one hand on Mundrain's shoulder and met those dark and serious eyes straight on. "There's not a single man in Their Majesty's uniform, not me, not even Admiral Lock Island and all the other men who died out on the Markovian Sea, who's done more than you've done here with Commodore Seamount. Not one. Believe me when I tell you that." Mondrain faltered for a moment, then nodded. "Thank you, sir." "No, thank you, Commander. You and the Commodore have come through for us again just as I expected you to. And because you have," the Admiral smiled suddenly, eyes glinting with deviltry, "I'll be coming up with another little challenge for you, as soon as I can think of it."
4. Sidamark City, Republic of Sidamark. One would have expected God's own personal navy to fare better than that, wouldn't one? Madame Eva Parsan remarked, turning her head to look over one shapely shoulder at her guest. A slender hand gestured out the window at the broad grey waters of North Bedard Bay. Madame Parsan's tastefully furnished apartment was on one of the better streets just outside the city's Carisian quarter, only a block or so from where the Sidamark River poured into the bay. Its windows usually afforded a breathtaking view of the harbour, but today the normally blue and sparkling bay was a steel-coloured mirror of an equally steel-coloured sky, while cold wind swept icy herringbone waves across it. A bleaker, less inviting vista would have been difficult to imagine, but that delicate waving hand wasn't indicating the bay's weather. Instead, its gesture took in the handful of galleons anchored well out from the city's wharves. They huddled together on the frigid water as if for support, managing to look pitiful and dejected even at this distance. "One would have hoped it wouldn't have been necessary for God to build a navy in the first place," her guest replied sadly. He was a lean, sparsely built man with silver hair, and his expression was considerably more grave than hers. He moved a little closer to her so that he could look out the window more comfortably, and his eyes were troubled. "And while I can't pretend the Carisians deserve the sort of wholesale destruction Clintan wants to visit upon them, I don't want to think about how he and the others are going to react to what happened instead," he continued, shaking his head. "I don't see it imposing any sense of restraint, anyway." "Why ever should they feel restraint, Your Eminence?" Madame Parsan asked acidly. "They speak with the very authority of the archangels themselves, don't they?" The silver-haired man winced. For a moment, he looked as if he wanted to argue the point, but then he shook his head. "They think they do," he said in a tone which conceded her point, and her own eyes softened. "Forgive me, Your Eminence. I shouldn't take out my anger on you. And that's what I'm doing, I suppose. Pitching a tantrum," she smiled slightly. "It would never have done in Zion, would it?" "I imagine not," her guest said with a wry smile of his own. "I wish I'd had more of an opportunity to watch you in action, so to speak, then. Of course, without knowing then what I know now, I wouldn't truly have appreciated your artistry, would I?" "I certainly hope not." Her smile blossomed into something very like a grin. "It would have meant my mask was slipping badly. And think of your reputation. Archbishop Zazin Kania visiting the infamous courtesan, Anzelic Fonda. Your parishioners in Glacier Heart would have been horrified." "My parishioners in Glacier Heart have forgiven me a great deal over the years, Eva," Zazin Kania told her. "I'm sure they would have forgiven me that as well." If anyone had even noticed a single lowly archbishop amongst all those vicars, that is. They weren't all venal and corrupt, Your Eminence, she said softly, sadly. And even a lot of the ones who were both those things were more guilty of complacency than anything else. You don't have to defend them to me, my dear. He reached out to touch her forearm gently. I knew them as well as you did, if not in precisely the same way. He smiled again, squeezed her arm and released it, then gazed out the window at those distant, anchored ships once more. As he watched, a guard boat appeared, rowing in a steady circle around them, as if to protect them from some shore-based pestilence. Or, perhaps, to protect the shore from some contagion they carried, he thought grimly. I knew them, he repeated. And too many of them are going to pay just as terrible a price as our friends before this is all ended. You think so? The woman now known as Ava Parsan turned to face him fully. You think it's going to come to that? Of course it is, he said sadly. And you know it as well as I do. It's inevitable that Clintarn, at least, will find more enemies among the vicarate. Whether they're really there or not is immaterial as far as that's concerned. And, his eyes narrowed as they gazed into hers, you and I both know that what you and your agents are up to in the Temple Lands will only make that worse. Do you think I'm wrong to do it, then? She asked levelly, meeting his eyes without flinching. No, he said after a moment, his voice even sadder. I hate what it's going to cost, and I have more than a few concerns for your immortal soul, my dear. But I don't think you're wrong. There's a difference between not being wrong and being right, but I don't think there is any right choice for you, and the writ tells us no true son or daughter of God can stand idle when his work needs to be done. And, dreadful as I think some of the consequences of your efforts are likely to prove, I'm afraid what you're set upon truly is God's work. I hope you're right, Your Eminence. And I think you are, although I try to remember that that could be my own anger and my own hatred speaking, not God. Sometimes I don't think there's a difference anymore. Which is why I have those concerns for your soul, he said gently. It's always possible to do God's work for the wrong reasons, just as it's possible to do terrible things with the best of all possible motives. It would be a wonderful thing if he gave us the gift of fighting evil without learning to hate along the way. But I suspect only the greatest and brightest of souls ever managed that. Then I hope I'll have your prayers, Your Eminence. My prayers for your soul and for your success alike. He smiled again, a bit crookedly. It would be my pleasure, as well as my duty, to commend a soul such as yours to God under any circumstances. And given the debt I owe you, it would be downright churlish of me not to. Oh, nonsense. She struck him gently on the shoulder. It was my pleasure. I only wish, her expression darkened, I'd been able to get more of the others out. You snatched scores of innocent victims out of Clintarn's grasp, he said, his tone suddenly sterner. Women and children would have been tortured and butchered in that parody of justice of his, be they ever so blameless and innocent. Langhorne said, as you have done unto the least of God's children for good or ill, so you have done unto me. Remember that, and never doubt for one moment that all that innocent blood will weigh heavily in your favour when the time comes for you to face him and God. I try to remember that. She half whispered, turning back to the window and gazing sightlessly out across the bay. I try, but then I think of all the ones we had to leave behind. Not just the circle, Your Eminence. All of them. God gave man free will, Kania said. That means some men will choose to do evil, and the innocent will suffer as a result. You can't judge yourself guilty because you were unable to stop all the evil Clintarn and others chose to do. You stopped all it was in your power to stop, and God can ask no more than that. She stared out the window for several more moments, then drew a deep breath and gave herself a visible shake. You're probably right, Your Eminence, but I intend to do a great deal more to those bastards before I'm done. She turned back from the window, and the steel behind her eyes was plain to see. Not immediately, because it's going to take time to put the pieces in place. But once they are, Jasper Clinton may find wearing the Grand Inquisitor's cap a lot less pleasant than he does today. Carnier regarded her with a distinct sense of trepidation. He knew very few details of her current activities, and he knew she intended to keep it that way. Not because she distrusted him, but because she was one of the most accomplished mistresses of intrigue in the history of Zion. That placed her in some select company. Indeed, she had matched wits with the full suppressive power of the Office of Inquisition, and she had won. Not everything she had wanted, perhaps, and whatever she might say, or he might say to her, she would never truly forgive herself for the victims she hadn't managed to save. Yet none of that changed the fact that she had outmaneuvered the Grand Inquisitor on ground of his own choosing, from the very heart of his power and authority, and done it so adroitly and smoothly, he still didn't know what had hit him. Or who. The woman who'd contrived all of that, kept that many plots in the air simultaneously without any of them slipping, plucked so many souls, including Zazin Karnia's, from the Inquisition's clutches, wasn't about to begin letting her right hand know what her left hand was doing now unless she absolutely had to. He didn't resent her reticence, or think it indicated any mistrust in his own discretion, but he did worry about what she might be up to. "Whatever your plans, my dear," he said, "I'll pray for their success." "Careful, Your Eminence." Her smile turned suddenly roguish. "Remember my past vocation. You might not want to go around writing blank bank drafts like that." "Oh," he reached out and touched her cheek lightly, "I think I'll take my chances on that." "Madame Parsan, how nice to see you again." The young man with auburn hair and grey eyes walked around his outsized desk to take his visitor's subtly perfumed hand in both of his. He bent over it, pressing a kiss on its back, then tucked it into his elbow and escorted her across the large office to the armchairs facing one another across a low table of beaten copper. "Thank you, Master Quentin," she said as she seated herself. A freshly fed fire crackled briskly in the grate to her right, noisily consuming gleaming coal, which had probably come from Zazin Karnia's archbishopric in Glacierheart, she thought. Owain Quentin sat in the chair facing hers and leaned forward to personally pour hot chocolate into a delicate cup and hand it to her. He poured more chocolate into a second cup, picked it up on its saucer, and leaned back in his chair regarding her expectantly. "I must say, I wasn't certain you'd be coming today after all," he said, waving his free hand at the office window. The previous day's grey skies had made good on their wintry promise, and sleety rain pounded and rattled against the glass, sliding down it to gather in crusty waves in the corners of the panes. "I really would have preferred to stay home myself, all things considered," he added. "I'm afraid I didn't have that option," she smiled charmingly at him. "I've got quite a few things to do over the next few 5 days. If I started letting my schedule slip, I'd never get them done." "I can believe that," he said, and he meant it. The House of Quentin was by any measure the largest, wealthiest, and most powerful banking house in the Republic of Sidamok, and had been for generations. It hadn't gotten that way by accident, and a man as young as Owain Quentin wouldn't have held his present position, family connections or no, if he hadn't demonstrated his fitness for it. He'd been trusted with some of the house's most sensitive accounts for the last 5 years, which had exposed him to some fascinating financial strategists. Yet Ava Parsan was probably the most intriguing puzzle yet to come his way. Her primary accounts with the House of Quentin had been established over 2 decades ago, although he wouldn't have said she could possibly be a day past 35, and her balance was enviable. In fact, it was a lot better than merely enviable if he wanted to be accurate. Coupled with her long-established holdings in real estate and farmland, her investments in half a dozen of the Republic's biggest granaries and mining enterprises, and her stake in several of Siddhar City's most prosperous merchant houses, that balance made her quite possibly the wealthiest woman Owain had ever met. Yet those transactions and acquisitions had been executed so gradually and steadily over the years, and spread between so many apparently separate accounts, that no one had noticed just how wealthy she was becoming. And no member of the House of Quinton had ever met her either. Every one of her instructions had arrived by mail, by courier, in point of fact, and not even via the church's semaphore system or even Wyvern Post. It had all been very mysterious when Owain finally looked at her accounts as a whole for the first time. He might not have noticed her even now if the somnolent, steady pace of her transactions hadn't suddenly become so much more active. Indeed, they'd become almost hectic, including a series of heavy transfers of funds since the difficulties with Caris had begun. Yet despite the many years she'd been a customer of his house, no one seemed to know where she'd come from in the first place. Somewhere in the temple lands, that much was obvious, yet where and how remained unanswered questions. And the House of Quinton, for all its discretion, was accustomed to knowing everything there was to know about its clients. But not in this case. She had presented all the necessary documentation to establish her identity on her arrival, and there was no question of her authority over those widespread accounts. Yet she had simply appeared in Siddhar a month or so ago, stepping into the capital city's social and financial life as if she had always been there. She was beautiful, poised, obviously well-educated, and gracious, and a great many of the social elite knew her, or weren't prepared to admit they didn't know polite society's latest adornment at any rate, but Owain had been unable to nail down a single hard fact about her past life, and the air of mystery which clung to her only made her more fascinating. "I've brought the list of transactions with me," she said now, reaching into her purse and extracting several sheets of paper. She extended them across the table to him, then sat back sipping her chocolate while he unfolded them and ran his eyes down the lines of clean, flowing script. Those eyes widened, despite his best efforts to conceal his surprise as he read. He turned the first page and examined the second just as carefully, and his surprise segued into something else, something tinged with alarm. He read the third and final sheet, then folded them back together, laid them on the table top, and looked at her intently. "Those are an extraordinary list of transactions, Madame Passan," he observed, and she startled him with a silvery little chuckle. "I believe you'll rise high in your house's service, Master Quentin," she told him. "What you're really wondering is whether or not I'm out of my mind, although you're far too much the gentleman to ever actually say so." "Nonsense," he replied, "or at least I'd never go that far. I do wonder how carefully you've considered some of this, though." He leaned forward to tap the folded instructions. "I've studied the records of all your investment moves since our house has represented you, madam. If you'll forgive my saying so, these instructions represent a significant change in your established approach. At the very least, they expose you to a much greater degree of financial risk. They also offer the potential for a very healthy return," she pointed out. "Assuming they prosper," he pointed out in response. "I believe they will," she said confidently. He started to say something else, then paused, regarding her thoughtfully. Was it possible she knew something even he didn't? "At the moment," he said after a minute or two, "the shipping arrangements you're proposing to invest in are being allowed by both the Republic and Mother Church.
That's subject to change from either side with little or no notice, you realize. And if that happens, you'll probably, no, almost certainly, lose your entire investment.
I'm aware of that, she said calmly. The profit margin's great enough to recoup my entire initial investment in no more than 5 months or so, however. Everything after that will be pure profit, even if the arrangements should ultimately be disallowed. And my own read of the decision-making process within the temple, let us say, suggests no one's going to be putting any pressure on the Republic to interfere with them. Not for quite some time, at any rate. She'd very carefully not said anything about the group of four, Owain noticed. Given the fact that she clearly came from the temple lands herself, however, there was no doubt in his mind about what she was implying. "Do you have any idea how long quite some time might be?" he asked. "Obviously. That's bound to be something of a guessing game," she replied in that same calm tone. "Consider this, however. At the moment, only the Republic and the Silkians are actually succeeding in paying their full tithes to Mother Church. If these arrangements were to be terminated, that would no longer be the case." She shrugged. "Given the obvious financial strain of the Holy War, especially in light of that unfortunate business in the Markovian Sea, it seems most unlikely Vicar Robert and Vicar Zamzin are going to endanger their strongest revenue streams." He frowned thoughtfully. Her analysis made a great deal of sense, although the financial and economic stupidity which could have decreed something like the embargo on Carisian trade in the first place didn't argue for the group of four's ability to recognize logic when it saw it. On the other hand, it fitted quite well with some of the things his grandfather, Timon, had said, although, "I think you're probably right about that, madam," he said. "However, I'm a bit more leery about some of these other investments." "Don't be, Master Quentin," she said firmly. "Foundries are always good investments in times of uncertainty. And, according to my sources, all three of these are experimenting with the new cannon-casting techniques. I realize they wouldn't dream of putting the new guns into production without Mother Church's approval, but I feel there's an excellent chance that approval will be forthcoming, especially now that the Navy of God needs to replace so many ships." Owain's eyes narrowed. If there was one thing in the entire world of which he was totally certain, it was that the Church of God awaiting would never permit the Republic of Sidamark to begin casting the new model artillery. Not when the Council of Vicars, in its role as the Knights of the Temple Lands, had been so anxious for so long over the potential threat the Republic posed to the Temple Lands' eastern border. Only a fool, which no member of the House of Quentin was likely to be, could have missed the fact that Sidamark's foundries were the only ones in either Haven or Howard which had received no orders from the Navy of God's ordnance officers. Foodstuffs and ship timbers, coal and coke and iron ore for other people's foundries, even ironwork to build warships in other realms, yes. Artillery, no. Yet Madame Parsan seemed so serenely confident. "Very well, madam." He bent his head in a courteous, seated bow. "If these are your desires, it will be my honour to carry them out for you." "Thank you, Master Quentin," she said with another of those charming smiles. Then she set her cup and saucer back on the table and rose. "In that case, I'll bid you good afternoon and get out of your way." He stood with a smile of his own and escorted her back to the office door. A footman appeared with her heavy winter coat, and he saw an older woman, as plain as Madame Parsan was lovely, waiting for her. Owain personally assisted her with her coat, then raised one of her slender hands, gloved now, and kissed its back once more. "As always, a pleasure, madam," he murmured. "And for me as well," she assured him, and then she was gone. "So what do you make of Madame Parsan, Henry?" Gregor Stoner asked as he stood with his back to a roaring fireplace, toasting his posterior. "Madame Parsan, my lord?" Lord Henry Maiden, the Republic of Sidamark's Chancellor of the Exchequer, sat in a window seat, nursing a tulip-shaped brandy glass as he leaned back against the panelled wall of the council chamber. Now he raised his eyebrows interrogatively, his expression innocent. "Yes, you know, the mysterious Madame Parsan," the elected ruler of the Republic smiled thinly at him. "The one who appeared so suddenly and with so little warning. The one who floats gaily through the highest reaches of society and hobnobs with reformist clergymen, whose accounts are personally handled by Owen Quentin, whose door is always open to poets, musicians, milliners, dressmakers, and a man who looks remarkably like the apostate heretic and blasphemer Zazen Khania. That, Madame Parsan?" "Oh, that, Madame Parsan." Maiden smiled back at the Lord Protector. Here in the Republic of Sidamark, the Chancellor of the Exchequer was also in charge of little matters like espionage. "Yes, that one," Stonar said, his tone more serious, and Maiden shrugged. "I'm afraid the jury's still out, my lord. Some of it's obvious, but the rest is still sufficiently obscure to make her very interesting. She's clearly from the Temple Lands, and I think it's equally clear her sudden appearance here has something to do with Clintan's decision to purge the vicarate. The question, of course, is precisely what it has to do with that decision. You think she's a wife or daughter who managed to get out?" "Possibly. Or even a mistress," Maiden shrugged again. "The amount of cash and all those deep investments she had tucked away here in Siddar were certainly big enough to represent someone important's escape fund. It could have been one of the vicars who saw the axe coming, I suppose. Although, whoever it was must have been clairvoyant to see this coming." He grimaced distastefully. "If someone did see a major shipwreck ahead, though, whoever it was might have put it under a woman's name in an effort to keep Clintan from sniffing it out." "But you don't think that's what it is," Stoner observed. "No, I don't." Maiden passed the brandy glass under his nose, inhaling its bouquet, then looked back at the Lord Protector. "She's too decisive. She's moving too swiftly now that she's here." He shook his head. "No, she's got a well-defined agenda in mind, and whoever she is, and wherever she came from originally, she's acting on her own now, for herself, not as anyone's public front." "But what in God's name is she doing?" Stonar shook his head. "I agree her sudden arrival's directly related to Clintan's purge, but if that's the case, I'd expect her to keep a low profile like the others." The two men looked at one another. They'd been very careful to ensure that neither of them learned, officially, about the refugees from the Temple Lands who had arrived so quietly in the Republic. Most of them had continued onward, taking passage on Sidamarkian registry merchant vessels which somehow had Carisian crews and home ports. By now they must have reached or nearly reached the Carisian Empire and safety, and personally, Stonar wished them well. He wished anyone that unmitigated bastard Clintan wanted dead well. A handful of the refugees, however, had remained in Sidamark, seeking asylum with relatives or friends. At least two of them had found shelter with priests. Stonar was reasonably certain nourished reformist tendencies of their own. All of them, though, had done their very best to disappear as tracelessly as possible, doing absolutely nothing which might have attracted attention to them. And then there was Eva Parson. I doubt she'd spend so much time gadding about to the opera and the theatre if it wasn't part of her cover, Maiden said after a moment. And it makes a sort of risky sense, if she is up to something certain people wouldn't care for. High visibility is often the best way to avoid the attention of people looking for surreptitious spies lurking in the shadows. As to what she might be up to that the group of four wouldn't like, there are all sorts of possibilities. For one thing, she's investing heavily in the Carisian trade, and according to Timon, her analysis of why Clintan's letting us get away with it pretty much matches my own.
Of course, we could both be wrong about that. What I find more interesting, though, are her decisions to buy into her Raymond's new coking ovens, and her investments in foundries. Specifically, in the foundries Darius had been so interested in. Lord Darius Parker was Seneschal of Sidamark, which made him both the government minister directly responsible for the army, and also that army's commanding general. If there was anyone in the entire republic who Zaspar Clintown trusted even less, and hated even more, than Gregor Stonar, it had to be Darius Parker. Parker was well aware of that, and fully reciprocated Clintown's hatred. He was also as well aware as Stonar or Maiden of all the reasons the Republic had been excluded from any of the Church's military build-up, which was why he had very quietly and discreetly encouraged certain foundry owners to experiment, purely speculatively, of course, with how one might go about casting the new style artillery or the new rifled muskets. And as Parker had pointed out to Maiden just the other day, charcoal was becoming increasingly difficult to come by, which meant foundries could never have too much coke if they suddenly found themselves having to increase their output. "I don't think even that would bother me," Stonar replied. "Not if she wasn't sending so much money back into the temple lands. I'd be willing to put all of it down to shrewd speculation on her part, if not for that." "It is an interesting puzzle, my lord," Maiden acknowledged. "She's obviously up to something, and my guess is that, whatever it is, Clintan wouldn't like it. The question is whether or not he knows about it. I'm inclined to think not, or else the Inquisition would already have insisted we bring her in for a little chat. So then the question becomes whether or not the Inquisition is going to become aware of her, and, of course, whether or not we, as dutiful sons of Mother Church, desirous of proving our reliability to the Grand Inquisitor, should bring her to the Inquisition's notice ourselves." "I doubt very much that anything could convince us, but Clintan, you and I are dutiful sons of Mother Church, at least as he understands the term," Stonar said frostily. "True, only too true, I'm afraid." Maiden's tone seemed remarkably free of regret. Then his expression sobered. "Still, it's a move we need to consider, my lord. If the Inquisition becomes aware of her and learns we didn't bring her to its attention, it's only going to be one more log on the fire where Clintan's attitude is concerned." "Granted," Stonar nodded, waving one hand in a brushing away gesture. "Granted. But if I'd needed anything to convince me the group of four is about as far removed from God's will as it's possible to get, Clintan's damned atrocities would have done it." He bared his teeth. "I've never pretended to be a saintly sort, Henry. But if Zaspo Clintan's going to heaven, I want to know where to buy my ticket to hell now." Maiden's features smoothed into non-expression. Stonar's statement wasn't a surprise, but the Lord Protector was a cautious man who seldom expressed himself that openly, even among the handful of people he fully trusted. "If Parsan is conspiring against Clintan and his hangers-on, Henry," Stonar went on, "then more power to her. Keep an eye on her. Do your best to make sure she's not doing something we'd disapprove of, but I want it all very tightly held. Use only men you fully trust, and be sure there's no trail of breadcrumbs from her to us. If the Inquisition does find out about her, I don't want them finding any indication we knew about her all along and simply failed to mention her to them. Is that clear?" "Perfectly, my lord." Maiden gave him a brief, seated bow, then leaned back against the wall once more. "Although that does raise one other rather delicate point. Which is, if we should happen to realize the Inquisition is beginning to look in her direction, do we warn her?" Stonar pursed his lips, unfocused eyes gazing at something only he could see while he considered the question. Then he shrugged. "I suppose that will depend on the circumstances," he said then.
Not detecting her or mentioning her to the Inquisition is one thing. Warning her, and being caught warning her, is something else. And you and I both know that if we do warn her and she's caught anyway in the end, she will tell the Inquisitors everything she knows. He shook his head slowly. I wish her well. I wish anyone trying to make Clintan's life miserable well. But we're running too many risks of our own as it is. If there's a way to warn her anonymously, perhaps yes. But if there isn't, then I'm afraid she'll just have to take her chances on her own.
5. King's Harbour, Helen Island, Kingdom of Old Kyrus. Seagulls screamed and wyverns whistled shrilly, swooping and stooping above the broad expanse of King's Harbour. The winged inhabitants of Helen Island could hardly believe the largesse a generous nature had bestowed upon them. With so many ships cluttering up the waters, the supply of flotsam and plain old drifting garbage exceeded their most beatific dreams of greed, and they pounced upon it with gleeful abandon. Oared barges, waterhoys, sheer hulks, and a dozen other types of service craft made their ways in and around and through the press of anchored warships beneath that storm of wings. Newly mustered and still mustering, ships' companies fell in on decks, raced up and down masts, panted under the unrelenting demands of their officers, and cursed their leather-lunged, hectoring petty officers with all the time-honored, tradition-sanctified fervency of new recruits the universe over, yet that represented barely a fraction of the human energy being expanded throughout that broad harbor. Carpenters and shipfitters labored to repair lingering battle damage. Dockyard inspectors argued vociferously with working party supervisors. Pursers and clerks counted casks, barrels, crates, and bags of supplies, and swore with weary creativity each time the numbers came up wrong and they had to start all over again. Sailmakers and chandlers, gunners and quartermasters, captains and midshipmen, chaplains and clerks, flag lieutenants and messengers were everywhere, all of them, totally focused on the tasks at hand and utterly oblivious to all the clangor and rush going on about them. The sheer level of activity was staggering, even for the Imperial Carisian Navy, and the squeal of sheaves as heavy weights were lifted, the bellow of shouted orders, the thud of hammers and the clang of metal resounded across the water. Any casual observer might have been excused for assuming the scene was one of utter chaos and confusion, but he would have been wrong. Amidst that much bustling traffic, one more admiral's barge was scarcely noticeable, Dominic Stainer thought dryly, easing the peg which had replaced his lower right leg. It had been skillfully fitted, but there were still times the stump bothered him, especially when he'd been on his feet. Well, foot and peg, he supposed, longer than he ought to have been. And longer than he ought to have been was a pretty good description of most of his working days, since stepping into Brian Lock Island's shoes. Shoe, I suppose I mean, he reflected mordantly, continuing his earlier thought, then looked up as the barge slid under the overhanging stern of one of the anchored galleons. Her original name, Sword of God, was still visible on her transom, although the decision had already been taken to rename her when she was commissioned into Carisian service. Of course, exactly what the new name would be was one of the myriad details which hadn't been decided upon just yet, wasn't it? "In oars!" his coxswain shouted, and the oarsmen brought their long sweeps smartly inboard in a perfectly choreographed manoeuvre as he swung the tiller, sending them curving gracefully into Sword of God's dense shadow and laying the barge alongside the larger ship. "Chains!" the coxswain shouted, and the seaman perched in the bow reached out with his long boat hook and snagged the galleon's main chains with neat, practiced efficiency. "Smartly done, Bert," the admiral said. "Thank ye, my lord,"
Bertram Veldemann replied in a gratified tone. Rockpoint wasn't known for bestowing empty compliments, but he was known for honest praise when a duty or an evolution was smartly performed. The barge's other passengers remained seated as Rockpoint heaved himself upright. Tradition made the senior officer the last to board a small boat, and the first to debark. And as a junior officer, Rockpoint had subscribed to the theory that the tradition existed so that a tipsy captain or flag officer's dutiful subordinates could catch him when he tumbled back into the boat in a drunken heap. He had changed his mind as he grew older and wiser, and more senior himself, but there might just be something to the catching notion in his own case, he reflected now. He had actually learned to dance again, after a fashion at least, since losing his leg, but even a boat the size of his barge was lively underfoot, and he balanced carefully as he reached out for the battens affixed to the galleon's side.
If I had any sense, I'd stay right here on a thwart while they rigged a bosun's chair for me, he told himself dryly. But I don't, so I'm not going to. If I fall and break my full neck, it'll be no more than I deserve, but I'll be damned if they're going to hoist me aboard like one more piece of cargo.
He reached up, caught one of the battens, balanced on his artificial leg while he got his left foot ready, then pushed himself upward. He could feel his subordinates watching him, no doubt poised to rescue him when his foolishness reaped the reward it so amply deserved. At least King's Harbour water was relatively warm year-round, so if he missed the boat entirely, he wasn't going to freeze, and as long as he didn't manage to get crushed between the barge and the galleon, or pushed down under the turn of the bilge, he wouldn't drown either. Not that he had any intention of allowing his illustrious naval career to be terminated quite that humiliatingly. He heaved, and he had always been powerfully muscled. Since the loss of his leg, his arms and shoulders had become even more powerful, and they lifted him clear of the curtsying barge. He got the toe of his remaining foot onto another batten, clear of the barge's gunwale, then drew his peg up and wedged it carefully beside his foot before he reached upward once more. Climbing the side of a galleon had never been an easy task even for someone with the designed number of feet, and he felt himself panting heavily as he clambered up the battens.
"This really isn't worth the effort," he thought, baring his teeth in a fierce grin. "But I'm too stubborn and too stupid to admit that to anyone. Besides, the day I stop doing this will be the day I stop being able to do it."
He made it to the entry port, and bosun's pipe squealed in salute as he hauled himself through it onto the deck of what had once been Bishop Cornelis Harper's flagship. If the truth be known, the identity of its previous owner was one of the reasons he'd selected it to become one of the first prizes to be commissioned into Carisian service. That possibly ignoble but profoundly satisfying thought passed through his mind as the side boys came to attention and a short, compact officer in the uniform of a captain saluted.
High Admiral, arriving, the quartermaster of the watch announced,
which still sounded a bit unnatural to Rockpoint when someone applied the title to him.
Welcome aboard, sir,
the captain said, extending his hand.
Thank you, Captain Pruitt.
Rockpoint clasped forearms with the captain, then stepped aside and turned to watch as three more officers climbed through the entry port in descending order of seniority. The bosun's pipe shrilled again as another captain, this one on the tall side, stepped aboard, followed by Commander Mandrain and Lieutenant Stephen Erickson, Rockpoint's flag lieutenant. Erickson was about due for promotion to lieutenant commander, although Rockpoint hadn't told him that yet. The promotion was going to bring a sea command with it, of course. That was inevitable, given the Imperial Carisian Navy's abrupt, unanticipated expansion. Even without that, Erickson amply deserved the reward of which every sea officer worth his salt dreamed, and Rockpoint was pleased for young Stephen. Of course, it was going to be a pain in the ass finding and breaking in a replacement who'd suit the High Admiral half as well. Pruitt greeted the other newcomers in turn,
then stepped back, sweeping both arms to indicate the broad, busy deck of the ship. It looked oddly unfinished to any Carisian officer's eyes, given the bulwark's empty rows of gunports. There should have been a solid row of carronades, crouching squatly in those ports, but this galleon had never carried them. In fact, that had quite a bit to do with Rockpoint's current visit. The most notable aspect of the ship's upper works, however, were the bustling work parties. Her original masts had been retained, but they were being fitted with entirely new yards on the Carisian pattern, and brand new sails had already been sent up the foremast, and more new canvas was ascending the mainmast as Rockpoint watched. Her new headsails had already been rigged as well, and painting parties on scaffolding slung over her side were busy converting her original gaudy paint scheme into the utilitarian black and white of the Imperial Carisian Navy.
"As you can see, High Admiral, we've more than enough to keep us busy until you and Master Hausman get around to sending us our new toys," Pruitt said. "I'd really like to get her coppered as well, but Sir Dustin's explained to me why that's not going to happen."
The captain rolled his eyes, and Rockpoint chuckled. Unlike the ICN's purpose-built war galleons, the Navy of God ships used iron nails and bolts throughout, which made it effectively impossible to sheathe their lower hulls in copper. Rockpoint wasn't about to try to explain electrolysis to Captain Pruitt, and he was confident Sir Dustin Oliver's explanation had been heavy on "because it won't work, damn it," and considerably lighter on the theory.
"We may have to bite the bullet and go ahead and dry dock her eventually to pull the underwater iron and refasten her with copper and bronze so we can copper her," he said out loud. "Don't go getting your hopes up," he cautioned as Pruitt's eyes lit. "It'd cost a fortune, given the number of prizes we're talking about, and Baron Ironhill and I are already fighting tooth and nail over the Navy's budget. But if we're going to keep her in commission, it'd probably be cheaper in the long run to protect her against borers rather than replacing half her underwater planking every couple of years. And that doesn't even consider how much slower the prizes are going to be without it."
Pruitt nodded in understanding. The recent Carisian innovation of coppering warships below the waterline did more than simply protect their timbers from the shellfish who literally ate their way, often with dismaying speed, into the fabric of a ship. There would have been more than enough to make the practice worthwhile, despite its initial expense, but it also enormously reduced the growth of weeds and the other fouling which increased water resistance and decreased speed. The swiftness Carisian ships could maintain was a powerful tactical advantage, but if Rockpoint was forced to operate coppered and uncoppered ships together, he'd lose most of it, since a fleet was no faster than its slowest unit.